good evening. Very nice to see you and see some good friends here tonight. It's for writers to be invited to write about to talk about their books is probably the nicest thing for a writer. It really is, because it's a subject you love talking about, your book. So if you all get bored, which I hope you don't, you let me know. Okay, now this book, Return, I wrote it, I really wanted to write it. It may be there are people here already familiar with In Search of Fatima. Well, In Search of Fatima, of course, was the first memoir, and you might say this is a sort of volume two, but it's a standalone book. It doesn't rely on you having read In Search of Fatima to be able to. Although, if you have, you recognize some of the people in this book, but it is, as I say, a standalone book. Now, I wanted to write it, and you'll see the title. Because I wanted to really get across to the reader the whole notion of return. It's very important for the Palestinians. Return has a very special resonance. It's very fundamental to them. Any Palestinian, if you say al-awda in Arabic, return, they know exactly what you're talking about without you having to explain. So this was something that I felt was necessary to write about, to talk about. What I did was that I described 3 months in 2005 when I was in Ramallah. I went out there to work for the Palestinian Authority, and I lived there, and this was the period which this book covers. So unlike In Search of Fatima, which it sort of takes the reader from when I was a child in Jerusalem, then in London, and stuff like this, this is not like that. This is based in, and it is in Ramallah, although there are occasional journeys to Amman, to Jordan. But that's really the main place. Now, okay, so what did I want to get across in the book? I really wanted to give a picture of life for Palestinians under occupation, to give a picture of Palestine, what had happened to what remains of Palestine and is now partly Israel and partly the Palestinian occupied territories, what it felt like. Because you know as well as I do that if you read political reports or newspaper accounts which say the wall or checkpoints or something, you even in a way you have no image unless you've been. You don't have an image in your mind of what that really means. So you repeat it, but it doesn't give you any kind of idea of how it feels to be there. And so that's it. And very much I wanted to do that. And obviously, if you read it, you will be able to judge whether I've done that effectively or not. And so in a way, okay, what did I do? I invited the reader, if you like, in a way, to go on this journey with me, a journey in which I left London, and then I went to Ramallah, and then from Ramallah, I went to other places, to Hebron, to Nablus, to Jerusalem, to Gaza. And my hope was that as a narrator, as the guide, if you like, to the reader, that I was a very specific kind of guide, because I'm an insider-outsider, if you know what I mean. Because really, I'm outside Palestine and what it means, and it's in, you know, the culture and so on. Because I'm very anglicized, as you know, or people who know me, or you can hear. But at the same time, I really am an insider. I also come from the people, the culture, the way of life that exists in what has been what's left of Palestine. So I said to myself, okay, this probably would convey the idea better than if I had been somebody sitting in the West Bank and had never been anywhere else, or alternatively, I were a Western person, say a journalist, with great respect to journalists here who I know have covered Palestine. This is different. I don't know. I can't tell you if I will. Now, I don't particularly... Well, let me not go on describing the book, is because in my experience, the best way to get an idea about a book is to have some extracts from it, to hear some extracts, which gives you a flavour, I think, of what it's about. Now, okay, so I've chosen a few extracts here to share with you, which I hope will give you a kind of general idea of what this book is like. Now, in the first of all, when I arrived in Ramallah, I was working for a ministry in the Palestinian Authority, and I wasn't sure what to expect, but certainly not what I found, which was a quite well-developed bureaucracy in the worst sense of that term, and people who were living, honestly, I can only tell you, a sort of collective fantasy that this was a state, that it has ministries, there's a prime minister, there's a president, and for all the world, you know, it's a state. Now, it's got a few problems with Israel, but it is a state. Well, of course, you know and I know that nothing could be further from the truth. And in reality, living in Ramallah, which is really quite an eye-opener, living in Ramallah, you could be forgiven if you thought that it's true. It was true. If you stayed in Ramallah, don't try to come out. Because while you're there, there are lots of restaurants, lots of cafes, lots of bistros, lovely. And you can have a lovely social time and run around and feel very good. The moment you say to yourself, oh, I feel like going to Jerusalem, or I feel like going... Then you will see the reality, which is, of course, that there are checkpoints all around Ramallah. There are, if you look up, instead of looking down into the cafe, if you just look up, you can see all the settlements bordering Ramallah. And, of course, the reality is very grim, and it's not a cafe life or a cafe society. Anyway, now, I then got away to start to be looking around me. And in this first extra... I have my glasses... In this first extract, I'd made a nice friend, a woman called Annetta, who had lived in Ramallah for quite a while, was one of these quite experienced foreigners who lived there and sort of had a very... she knew her way around, etc., and she befriended me, which was very nice for me because I didn't know much. And on this particular occasion, she took me to a demonstration against the wall. I said I was very eager to go, and she said, okay, there's a few of us who go regularly, and people who know about these protests of the wall will know that they're quite regular occurrences. And so I went with her. Now, the thing is, I, like you, I think, or those of you who haven't been, I saw pictures of the wall, and I knew facts about it, but really to look at it, to come close to it, is something quite different. So there was a demonstration, there was... Oh, yes. Now, I left them standing there demonstrating. I walked right up to the wall on my own, staring at it. It wound along the side of the street all the way up to the top, where it curved sideways to form a complete shield that shut off the light and everything else behind it. Higher up along its course and inserted into its side was a huge cylindrical watchtower with sinister-looking apertures for windows all around the top, where I imagined armed soldiers to be monitoring what went on below. The wall here was at least 8 meters or 26 feet high, and I thought, how impossible it would be to scale its late grey slabs of solid concrete. I stood close up against it and pressed my palms over its surface. The concrete felt cold and smooth against my skin, and I had to crane my head backward to see up to the top. It felt powerfully solid and immovable. Now, as I was standing there, somebody came up to me. It was a Palestinian woman who told me that behind that wall was her husband and their home. And what had happened is the wall had come between their house and the other side, which was incorporated into Israel. And she, because she had a Jerusalem ID, it was a big problem for them. So she stayed on the Jerusalem side, and he could only visit when he got a permit. Now, I looked at the wall and so on, and then after a while, Annetta said to me, come on, we've got to go. And so she got into the car, and I followed her slowly, haunted by what I had just seen. I wondered why I felt so disturbed by it. After all, Israel's transgressions against the Palestinians were nothing new to me. I had been campaigning against them since 1971 and was familiar with the long catalogue of its attacks and misdemeanours over the years. Surely the wall was but another addition to a long, unsavoury list. But yet it wasn't. It was in a different league, a symbol of something indefinably cruel, a brutal expression of Israeli entitlement. What else could explain these mighty fortifications, as if wild beasts and ravening wolves roamed the other side and had to be kept out at all costs? Of course, the wall was not everywhere like that, you know. Sometimes it's like a fence with very deep trenches dug on either side. And you know, if you looked at it, it wound in and out of Palestinian territory in such a way as to enclose the best farming land and water sources within the Israeli side. A plain and simple seizure of other people's property. But for me, the wall signified much more. For behind its huge bulk was blotted out, and deliberately so, the physical presence, the very thought even, of another people who walked and breathed there, as if they had no right even to be alive. Its brazen message to the world was that this country was Israel's and Israel's alone, to settle, loot, divide, carve up, refashion, rename, and do with whatever it pleased. So, you know, it was terribly shocking, etc., but it was worse to come, as they say. Now, of course, there were kind of humorous sides to this, believe it or not, and in this next extract, I went to Nablus with Annetta and some friends to hear a recital. And that, by the way, is quite noticeable. It's lovely that there's still, or remarkable, let's say, that life goes on. You know, people have recitals and they do things and they go and travel and they have picnics. And, you know, travel within from time to time. And so in this extract, we'd gone, Annetta drove, and we had with us Samir, who is a youngish Palestinian who lived in the U.S. and had come to Ramallah and was a very, very patriotic, very passionate about the Palestine cause. And so we went to the recital, and there were some other people. Anyway, and it was very nice. We enjoyed it. We really thought they sang very well. Now, there was a checkpoint. Now, the checkpoint outside Nablus is really horrific because it's called Al-Huwara checkpoint, and it's very, very, it's formidable and very nasty, and a terrible reputation. Anyway, as we drove off towards the checkpoint, "Aren't they great?" said Samir excitedly afterwards. Yes, those two ladies are wonderful, said Annetta. I've heard them before. No, not the musicians. I mean the people, the great people of Nablus. We were back in Annetta's car on the start of our return journey. Look at them. His eyes were shining. Their spirit, their guts. You'd never think that just down the road there was an army camp or that hideous checkpoint we went through. They were goddamn well gonna enjoy that concert. What the hell, no matter who was playing, what kind of music. He moved his head from side to side in admiration. God damn it, they're just great. I had always found Palestinians like him, brought up in the US and speaking like typical Americans, rather disconcerting. They did not come across as Arabs, but as part of the enemy camp. The country that had nurtured Israel for decades and was its most loyal friend. I felt guilty even having such a thought, for Samir's patriotism and utter commitment to the cause were not in doubt. And yet, his reactions to what went on around him, however passionate, were still somehow those of an interested tourist or an outsider looking in. It was a fear I had about myself. How much, I wondered, did my English accent and manner place me in that much older enemy camp, the one which was the source of the problem, which had created Israel and was so infinitely more culpable? Perhaps I was also something of a tourist, an observer of a scene I was not part of. Now, we got the checkpoint, and when we'd come in, quite unusually, there'd been not much trouble. They let us in quite easily. But when we were due to go out, it was different. There were two soldiers who were quite difficult, and they stopped us. You always have to stop at the checkpoint, and they looked at our passports. You always have to give your passport. They looked at our passports, and he lingered over Samir's. Havia, the older man demanded. This was a Hebrew rendering of the Arabic Hawiya, or identity card. West Bank Palestinians all carried these cards, and although Samir, whose family originally came from Ramallah, had a U.S. passport, the West Bank ID was the only thing that counted under Israeli law. The soldiers examined his ID closely and then looked at the rest of us as they checked our passports. They asked where we had been. We were at a concert in Nablus, replied Annetta. You know many people there? Well, yes, I have friends in Nablus. This seemed to irritate them. And you? They were looking at me. No, I don't know anyone there. But what is all this about? Why have you stopped us? I could see Annetta trying to dissuade me from saying more with a faint shake of her head. Yeah, come on, give us the reason, Samir said pugnaciously, seeming ready for a fight. The soldiers stared at him. I don't think their English was very good. Anyway, he got more and more heated, and I started to feel nervous. And then the soldiers turned on their walkie-talkies, and the older soldier began speaking into his... we didn't know what happened, but Samir was not deterred. So you don't have a reason. Good. So let us go. He turned towards us. Come on, guys. Let's go. He had said to them, give us the reason. He said, but of course you don't need reasons, do you? He was in a rage. You think you're God Almighty here, don't you? And we've got to do what you say no matter what. Well, buddy, you picked the wrong people. So when he said to us, come on, guys, let's go, the soldiers, it was like a red rag to a bull, they just sprang into action, they shoved him aside, and they told us to move on and get into the car. After a bit, a jeep came up. They'd obviously called for reinforcements, and out of this jeep, some other soldiers appeared. Please return to your car. This new soldier was more courteous and seemed senior to the rest. He was fair-haired and European-looking and spoke good English. It is better for you. "We can't leave our friend here," said Annetta. "Perhaps you could explain what the problem is." His manner was still courteous. "We have a few questions for your friend, and then you will let him go." "Depends," he said without elaborating. Meanwhile, Samir's temper had not improved. "You have no right to keep me," he yelled at the new soldiers. They ignored him and, moving nearer, edged us towards the car. "We'll wait for you, Samir," Annetta called out. "We'll park just the other side." The new soldiers checked our passports again, and the fair-haired soldier looked at me. "You live in London?" I nodded. "Where in London?" "I love London," he said. "I often go there to see friends." "I live in a part called Golders Green, but you probably wouldn't know it." If indeed he knew London, I thought, he could not fail to know Golders Green. We had moved there in 1949 when we took refuge in England following the loss of Palestine. It was an enormous irony that of all places, my father had chosen Golders Green, one of London's foremost Jewish areas and full of German Jewish refugees at the time. What an incongruous sight we must have been, the only Palestinian family in the middle of a Jewish neighborhood, and it was a subject of hilarity for everyone who heard about it. The soldier's eyes lit up. "Golders Green?" he said smilingly. "Of course I know Golders Green. My girlfriend lives there. I went many times. I love it." We exchanged experiences and stories about Golders Green, which I spun out, and he seemed to be enjoying himself. The other soldiers stood in the background. "When are you coming to London next?" I asked. "How about you visit me in Golders Green?" "Sure, why not? I will be there maybe in October." "Excellent, that's a date," I exclaimed. "So now, won't you please let our friend go? He really hasn't done anything. We were all on our way back to Ramallah." He paused and then turned to the other soldiers and said something to them, and then to me. "Listen, for the sake of Golders Green, I will think about it. Go in the car and wait." And in fact, he let him go. Sure. But what Golders Green, what part it played, I have no idea. Anyway, so there we are. And then one of the... how are we doing for time? Now, one of my trips quite early on took me to Jerusalem, of course, which is the city where I was born. And leaving Ramallah for Jerusalem was, of course, quite an experience, as usual, because of a very, for those who don't know it, a formidable checkpoint as you leave Ramallah to go into onto the road to Jerusalem called Qalandia. Really formidable, very terrible. And normally, because you can't go through, I mean, you can, but your car is, if you do in a car, you are examined, etc., and you have to have special number plates, etc. And but if you walk through the turnstile, as I did, you're thoroughly searched, and your papers are looked at, and your passports are, the usual. Anyway, by the time I got through it, and then I went into, I took the Jerusalem bus, and as soon as we got, no sooner had we got into the bus, and it hadn't gone very far really, it was stopped. A couple of soldiers got on the bus. Now, you know, we'd already been passed through the checkpoint. It was only, you know, just a very short distance from the checkpoint. And they stopped the bus, and two soldiers, one of them got onto it and said, passport, or, you know, their identity. So people had to do so, had to present their passports. Now, in my case, when we'd arrived, we were told by the UNDP, you know, the United Nations, which was my employer, that we didn't have to respond to this. So if we were asked for passports while we were there on our formal mission as UN employees, it wasn't necessary. Your card, which the UNDP gives you to show that you are an employee of the UN, is enough. They don't need a passport. And they assured us that was the case. So I said to this soldier, "No, you don't need it. Here's my ID." Well, he didn't understand it, and then in the end, he got me off the bus. And the bus was stopped while I went. They took me away, and the people in the bus were not happy because, you know, they were all going to be late. And he took me outside, and then when we got a little way from the bus, I saw from the distance, he must have called, and a jeep turned up and stopped by me. Inside and lolling on the front seat with his foot on the dashboard was a thick-set, dark-skinned soldier sucking on a straw and looking at me with faint amusement. He remained inside while I stood in the heat outside. "Come here," he said in Arabic. "I understand you have a problem with showing us your passport. Is that so?" This man was obviously in a different category to the youth I had just been able to browbeat, because actually the young soldier who came on the bus was a Russian. And I remember I felt like saying, what's a nice boy like you doing in a place like this, you know? He looked intimidated, but this man was quite different. "No," I answered in Arabic, "there's no problem, but my passport isn't necessary. I have a UNDP employee's card, which is all you need." He laughed loudly. "Listen, we decide what we need, not you. Now give me your passport." His arrogance and total air of command made me nervous. I could see he was a Druze from a minority Arab Islamic sect, which had thrown in its lot with Israel back in 1948, soon after the new state was created. Its members went on to make loyal Israeli citizens, proud of being nationalist and patriotic, and many were members of the Druze Zionist movement. They spoke about a blood pact between them and Israeli Jews, and early in Israel's history had been categorized as an ethnic community, unlike other Arabs. Nevertheless, they remained non-Jews in a Jewish state, and their community was still subject to discrimination, although to a lesser degree than other Arabs. And unlike the latter, they were recruited into Israel's army, many of them to serve as border police. This force was employed to control the Palestinians of the occupied territories and was widely feared by them for its harshness and brutality. What an anomaly, I thought, looking at this Druze soldier. Here we are, both Arabs, but on opposite sides. He, a servant of a state that had oppressed Arabs since its inception, and I, one of its victims. By all that was just, we should have been comrades, not enemies. Nevertheless, I knew I could expect little mercy from him if things went wrong. "I told you," I said, determined to hold out a little longer, "I have a United Nations ID, which is all you require. You can check with your people or with the UN office in Jerusalem, and you will find it is sufficient. Here it is. Look at it." I put my card up to show him. He did not even bother to turn his head to see it. But he did sit up from his recumbent position inside the jeep and fixed his eyes on me. "I want you to understand that here in Israel, your card and your UN and whoever else you like to mention is worth not so much as an onion peel. We don't give this much for any of them." He clicked his thumb and middle finger against each other. "Only our law counts. Only what we say and do counts. Get it? Now give me your passport." So, of course, that was it, you know, I had to, and, you know, I felt terrible. I was so humiliated when I got back onto the bus. It was very depressing. Anyway, I got to Jerusalem, and I went to the UNDP office there, and because I wanted to complain, because it was my job was dreadful. I mean, that's another story which you'll read about. Anyway, while I was there, that evening, I received a very strange invitation. I had been invited a little while back to visit. I'd been contacted by the bureau chief of the New York Times, a man called Stephen Erlanger. And he said to me, I don't know how he got my email, but anyway, he emailed to say, "I've come across your book. I feel quite certain that the house I'm in was your house from your description. And would you like to come and visit me and have a look or something?" I thought, well, what an invitation. So I had a young Palestinian friend with me, and off we went to see him. Indeed, it was the house. But what had happened was that somebody at some point, I mean, these were, villas, typical of a style. They had no second floor. They were like bungalows, you see. But what had happened here is that they built a story on top of ours, of our house. And this belonged to the New York Times. So their bureau chiefs always lived there. Anyway, I went to see him, and I said, "You're right. This is the house, I want to thank you for inviting me, and so on." And I said, "Why did you invite me? By the way, was it just to confirm that this was my house?" "No, not just that," he said earnestly. "I found parts of the book fascinating, particularly the description of life here in the 1940s. Great stuff. And I wanted to meet and maybe show you your old house. You see, I know the people downstairs. They're really nice. And we talked about you coming to visit. They'd be delighted to meet you. I want to take photos of you in the house that you can keep here." And he pointed to a large professional-looking camera on a table in the sitting room. "Were you thinking of writing a piece about it for your paper?" I asked. He looked taken aback. No, the photos are for you. I thought you would want to have a memento of your old house." "That's very kind, but have you thought of doing an article on this story?" I persisted. "It would be a bold step, I grant you, for your paper to agree, but it would make a refreshing change to present this story from the Palestinian side, don't you think?" He cleared his throat. "That's not the idea at all. I simply wanted to have you get inside your old home because I know that's not so easy for many Palestinians to do. I know how they get turned away when they try. So there's a friendly family living in the house who are happy to let you in. You can look around for as long as you like." He made it sound like largesse from the current owners. "And we should go while it's still light." "Thank you. It's an offer I won't refuse. But could I ask you another question?" He looked faintly alarmed. "You've read my book and identified this place as being my family home. You also know that we're no longer in it because of what happened in 1948. The fact that you're here, your newspaper's here, and your friends downstairs are here, is because we're not here, if you see what I mean. I know you didn't need my book to tell you that, but it gave you the story again from a personal human angle, how it felt to have to leave this house and the details of what happened here." He nodded, waiting for me to continue. "So knowing what you know, seeing me right here in front of you, and Rami too, whose parents were dislocated from their homes in 1948, just as we were, I wanted to ask how that makes you feel about Israel now." Clearly, he had not anticipated any of this. After a pause, he said he was aware of how difficult matters must have been in 1948, but that was in the past, and things had moved on since then. He had not answered my question, and I felt it was important for him to do so, even though it must have seemed ungracious to respond in that way to the kindness he was perhaps doing me by inviting me to see my old house. But there was an underlying smugness about him, which I found irritating. "What I'm really asking you is if you feel comfortable being in a country which came into being like that, which had to get rid of people like me and take their place to build its state, which keeps me from returning, from getting my house back. I mean, you can see the result. You're physically occupying a house which belonged to other people, and you feel nothing about that? Look, these things are difficult. They're not black and white. You have to remember, history is important here. Some things aren't either right or wrong." Now, in fact, I persisted. He really was so evasive, and you couldn't pin him down, and that was that. And may I tell you, just apropos of that, just about a year ago, the New York Times bureau chief, a woman called Judy... Yes, Rodin. Or No. Yes, she had tweeted something about how lovely the house was or something. So I tweeted saying, do you enjoy living in stolen property? And that led to quite an interesting exchange. And she said, look, I mean, I can't help it. I mean, she could be very defensive. And she said, I'd love to meet you. Do you ever come to Jerusalem? So I said, yes, I'm. She said, please look me up, please. So I haven't, but there we are. Now, I'm aware of time, and I don't want you to get bored. So let me see, we're probably coming towards the last of these. Yeah, now, in this last but one extract, I, of course, as I told you, I went to Gaza. And that was, you know, quite something. There are two chapters on Gaza. And on the first visit, I met a senior Hamas leader called Mahmoud al-Zahar, if people have heard about him or. And he's really an important figure. He's a sort of thoughtful person who's, you know, says a lot about ideas, etc. So I was very glad to be able to sit with him and to talk. And as we did so, this, I think, is an insight into the way such people think. And we were talking about what he thought the solution was, etc. And he said to me that there is only really one way. We all have to live together, he said, in peace and friendship. So I said to him, but do you really think that's possible? I mean, Jewish Israelis have got used to having everything and a position of dominance. How do you imagine they would settle down? He regarded me with a mixture of surprise and impatience, as if I should have known better. Do you imagine that any harm would come to the Jews because they are here? I noticed he never used the term Israel or Israelis. They will not be expelled or made to suffer as they fear and as the world accuses us of aiming for, but they have to learn their place and understand they are in our region, not the other way around. They will live under our rule and find peace and contentment, never fear. Islam is a religion of tolerance and justice. Look at what they've created in our country, left to themselves, misery, oppression, and injustice. We will never be like that. Our religion, our God, would never allow it. These Jews have strayed from their God and made him evil and cruel like them, incapable of compassion. Under our rule, it will be different. I could see he was serious and spoke out of a sincere piety. He believed wholeheartedly in what he was saying. And then we went on, and I asked him about the suicide operations. Yes. How does that fit in with the vision you described? Please be clear, he said. I advocate force only against those who use force against us. We never started any war against them, yet they have fought us from the beginning. What have our babies, our children, done to them that they kill them without mercy? By what right do they bomb us and put us in prison for wanting our freedom? What we do is in self-defense only. We are not the aggressors. It is the Islamic way to defend against aggression, not to start it. Yes, I had actually asked him about being hardline. Now here I said to him, and suicide operations, where do they fit into all this? He frowned, not liking the term I used. Look, we Palestinians are in a war not of our making. Israel has been at war with us from the first moment of its existence. It has big guns, cluster bombs, F-16s, Apache helicopters, tanks, and uses them all against us. We have none of these things. So should we do nothing? No. We use what weapons we have in return. Our martyrs sow terror in their hearts. The Jews have no defense against fear. They are a fearful people because they have no morals. Our operations have wrecked their tourism and their economy. And actually, he had a point, because during the early years of the First Intifada, The Second Intifada, Israeli economy was really, really affected in a very big way, etc. So anyway, I don't want to go on. You've got the idea. And I just, my final thing is a very short extract, and I'm sorry if I've tired you out. But in this last very short extract, I wanted to share with you something I feel very strongly, and I suspect many other Palestinians do. Sometimes driving along a beautiful road like the one going north from Ramallah as the sun was setting on the horizon, I would gaze at the long shadows of ancient trees slanting down onto the quiet hillsides and imagine how it must have been before anyone was here, before modern Israel and its soldiers and bulldozers arrived, before its settlers, religious zealots, and military checkpoints disrupted that gentle harmony. In these imaginings, I knew I was not alone. I had a rival in every religious Jew who saw the same landscape and fancied it came straight out of the Hebrew Bible. Just as the Christian travelers who came to what they called the Holy Land thought themselves to be walking in the footsteps of Jesus. It was Palestine's great misfortune that it fed so many fantasies and answered to so many emotional needs. For centuries, people had pinned their dreams and illusions on its land, seen it as their salvation, and tried to make it exclusively their own. If only it had been an ordinary place, without a special history or a sacred geography, without religion or scripture, then perhaps we, its people, might have been left in peace.